From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. California's firefight this year will be boosted by more funding to Cal Fire and the Office of Emergency Services. That's something the governor is going to talk about in his budget message, which is today at noon. In the midst of this COVID-19 battle, the state has already had to fight more wildfires than last year.
We just ran some numbers from January to May 10th last year. We had 675 wildfires. From January to May 10th this year, we've had 1,135 wildfires. Represents roughly a 60% increase this year compared to last year in the total number of wildfires.
So 26 new fire engines will be added by July, says the governor, as well as Black Hawk helicopters that the governor's long been talking about.
We're not going to walk that back. It's just too important in terms of our mutual aid and public safety in the state of California. I want folks to know those helicopters are now arriving. First one came in October of last year. In fact, it was just used in that red fire up in Tehama County. These Black Hawks are extraordinary. They provide faster suppression capacity, a more robust ability in terms of number of gallons of water that they're able to disperse. They're safer for our personnel in terms of redundancy, double twin turbine engine. I can go on and on with the specs of these.
Well, at noon today, the governor will be talking about budgets. His revised message with analysis begins on your public radio station hosted by Cap Radio at noon. In the COVID-19 battle, meanwhile, you might not personally know someone who's been seriously ill, but we do at Cap Radio. She is Katie Cooper. She's the daughter of our colleague, Lisa Cooper. Katie's in her 30s. She's an actor, singer, and writer. She sometimes steps in here as a receptionist at Cap Radio, and she's been really healthy until this illness that she is still trying to recover from. Katie's on the phone to share her story. And Katie, thanks a lot for talking with me today.
Good morning, Beth. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to share. I think sharing these stories might help some to understand and hopefully help some to feel like they're not alone. I know that when I have heard stories that ring a bell for me, it's like, oh, yes, this was real. This is what happened. You know, it's not just me. And so if I can contribute to that, I'm happy to do it.
So when did this begin and what was your first symptom?
My first symptom was sort of tightness in my chest. That grew into shortness of breath, and that began on March 25th.
And you recognized or you suspected that this was COVID-19? By then, you knew what the symptoms were.
Yeah, at that point, what we were hearing was, fever, cough, and shortness of breath. And if I had not had the phrase shortness of breath as sort of a reference point, I don't know that I would have really paid much attention right at first. But because it was so in the zeitgeist, I really noticed it and I was like, okay, so this is happening. And I sort of prepared to hunker down, be in quarantine. I'd already been practicing social distancing for a while at that point, but full isolation and Tylenol, Mucinex, all the, supplements and vitamins and things. And I fully expected to be sick. We all know how to take care of ourselves when we're sick. And then I expected to be well again in about a week, and that is simply not what happened.
When you did feel lousy for that first week, you and your mom were living in the house together. So did you start to change your patterns with each other?
That's right, yeah. So sharing a home with someone who is not exhibiting those symptoms was sort of an added stressor. I was really scared of getting her sick, and so we actually happened to have some rubber gloves that were just like out in the garage. I began using them if I had to go outside of my bedroom or touch anything that she may come in contact with. I was wearing gloves. I was spraying everything with vodka water and or hydrogen peroxide. We were very careful. As much as we could, we live in a house that's not entirely conducive. You might run into each other in the hallway, and there's some shuffling that has to happen. So we were very careful, and mostly we were able to really keep that distance as well by, I tried to stay just in my bedroom. And if I had to go out, into the bathroom, into the kitchen, I was really, really trying to be very conscious. Mm. And I also really sort of fixated on a few things like dishes. I don't know why in my head at that time, dirty dishes was good, how she was going to get it. That is totally irrational. Dishes over anything else is probably not true, but in my state, that was the thing that I could do, I guess, to try and keep her safe. So I did it.
Well, from what I understand, you moved Katie into this cycle of feeling better for a few days, and then you would have a day where you felt lousy and then feel better and lousy. But then over time, I think the reason I really wanted everybody to hear this story is that you started to realize you were struggling psychologically, that the anxiety of the length of this was really becoming part of the debilitating nature of its own. Would you talk more about that?
Absolutely. It was very real, and not only the duration, though that is definitely a piece of it, but the nature of it, like you said, I would have maybe a couple of days of sort of stasis, and then 2 days of starting to feel better, and then one day that was really a drawback, and I really felt even worse, and then it would sort of balance out again. And so every time the days of feeling better would come on, you think, okay, well, here it is. So maybe I was starting to get better and then I overdid it. So I really need to make sure I don't overdo it this time. So I continue to get better, but it never takes. It kept pulling me backwards again. And so it was a really long time. I was fully sick for 35 days, and I am still at this point, I don't even know how many days anymore, but from March 25th, I am still not fully recovered, though I do feel I am in recovery rather than being ill, which is sort of an ineffable difference, but it was a shift that was very real to me when I felt it.
Katie, how were can I ask how the night times were for you?
Night times were rough. My symptoms were worse in the evenings. They would come on. I would start feeling worse usually around 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, evening, and so the onset of like feeling worse physically was very much a pattern, but. Also, around week two, during the second week, I was feeling like I should be getting better by now. Now at this point, I'm hearing that there are a lot of cases where it is more like 2 weeks to the crest rather than 1 week and then a week of getting better. But at that point, I really felt like, why am I not healing yet? And so there was a lot of anxiety, and that was also always worse at night, and especially at bedtime, around going to bed, around going to sleep, I had a lot of anxiety about going to bed and staying there, not waking up. That fear was a little bit constant, but definitely consistent when I was getting ready for bed.
Do you mean, and, Katie, when you mean staying in bed, do you mean you were afraid that you might die in your sleep?
I was afraid that I might die in my sleep, and there were times when beyond that I was convinced of it. Yeah.
Was that because the shortness of breath was so bad?
Shortness of breath and trouble breathing. There were times when I can't tell if I was actually asleep at this point or still trying to go to sleep, but I can remember being in my bed and waking with a gasp. And so that sensation combined with some of the stories that had come out, by that point I was on a full news block. I couldn't handle any news at all. But some of those stories from earlier on had stuck with me. And so, yeah, it felt like if I am not consciously, intentionally breathing, I might stop. It might just be too hard for my body to do automatically. I don't know how realistic that is looking back with a rational brain, but that was very much my reality at the time. And the fact that, I mean, there was evidence for it. My struggle to breathe while I was laying down was greater, and enough so to have awakened me. So that fear was very real. It was very much always at least bubbling in the back of my mind, and a lot of times it really came to the fore, and that fear really crested for me at the 2-week mark. There was one night that I was convinced I would die if I went to sleep, and so for hours and hours I stood in the bathroom staring at myself in the mirror to make sure I was still real and make sure I was still there. I turned the light on. I stared at myself in the mirror. I tried to focus on different features. You hear in a panic attack that grounding yourself with your senses can help. And I don't know if I was doing that intentionally or intuitively, or if it was very different experience of reality and of my body than I had ever experienced before. So maybe trying to anchor myself down into my body and stay there, I don't know. But there was a thought in my head at that time that if I go into distress while I'm standing here in the bathroom, not only am I more comfortable here than in bed, but if I collapse, our house is arranged such that the bathroom is the next door room to my mom's bedroom. And it was a very real thought to me that if I collapsed in here, she'll hear me. And if I go into distress in my bed, no one will know. So I stayed there for hours. And eventually the dog woke my mom up. And she came in and asked me what was going on. And she stayed up with me for the rest of that night. It was about 7:30 in the morning before I could finally relax and get some rest. And that was the most trying night of my entire life.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Katie Cooper of Sacramento. She's describing her experience with COVID-19. It was clinically diagnosed. And Katie, we need to explain this. You did not have a swab test available to you at the beginning, so the diagnosis came through your communication with your doctor, correct?
That's correct, yeah. I got in touch with my doctor about the end of the first week that I was ill. As I said earlier, when I first felt it coming on, I sort of felt like, okay, get prepared. We're going to take care of this and it's going to be fine. And then about the end of the first week when I expected to start feeling better and I didn't, I reached out to my doctor. And we had a phone appointment and we are in regular contact. I don't know about constant contact, but just about every few days to check in and, make sure I'm still doing the right things and to check on, it's been another it's been another week and I'm still not getting better. Is this normal? And also having to temper those questions with, you know, do we know if this is normal yet? What information is available to even, you know, can we answer these questions? She took excellent care of me, and we made a plan. We continued with that plan after the that Wednesday night, which was the worst of it. I got back in touch with her that next day, and she prescribed me a medication for anxiety and insomnia, and she told me to take it at bedtime and as needed if I needed it during other times of the day. And that was really a saving grace.
Hey, Katie, was there ever a time that there was discussion about you being in the hospital?
There was not. The plan had been and remained staying at home, taking care with all of the tools that we have. There didn't come a time for sort of physical care by a provider until the fifth week, or at the end of the fifth week. So,
and I'm going to jump in here and just fast track and let everybody know that you did develop bronchitis as a secondary infection. But I want to advance us to say it's now been 50 days by the calendar. You're still not 100%. So just in the final little bit of time we have, to what degree do you feel at this point like yourself again?
Emotionally, I feel very much back to myself. I'm still processing a lot of what happened and sort of realizing in how I frame this for myself as I navigate it as a trauma, not just an illness. So there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah.
But I feel like a human. I feel like myself. My mom has said, "You're back. You were gone and you're back."
Well, we're going to leave it right there, Katie.
Yeah.
And I'm just so glad. We're all glad here to cheer you on and know that you are back. I can hear it in your voice. And we look forward to seeing you again sometime at CAP Radio. But a lot of big hugs around you, okay?
Thank you so much, Beth. And big love to my mom and CAP Radio. She's spent her whole career there, and I'm so proud of her. So I'm feeling lucky to be a part of that as well.
That's Katie Cooper talking about her experience with COVID-19. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the early weeks of COVID-19, people struggling with fever or cough or breathing problems were often coming to the hospital through the emergency room. But I know you remember that testing was limited, and it was a challenging time to distinguish COVID-19 patients from people with other respiratory illnesses. My next guest is going to describe his experience at the UC Davis Medical Center. He is Dr. Nathan Cooperman. He is an ER doctor, the chair of emergency medicine at UC Davis Health, and professor of pediatric emergency medicine. So we're also going to talk a bit about that emerging COVID-linked disease in children. Dr. Cooperman, thanks so much for making time to talk with me on Insight.
Thanks, Beth. It's a pleasure to be here.
I don't know what kind of hindsight you have at this point, but how were those early days of this disease in the ER as you were just starting to put the pieces together?
Beth, yeah, that is a really interesting story, because as we all face this new pandemic that we had not seen before in our lifetimes, we were busily preparing, first of all, how to best care for patients in a safe fashion, and secondly, how to be safe ourselves, how to protect ourselves so that healthcare providers were not falling ill and not able to care for patients. So that really required, the first few weeks were a bit pandemonious in the preparations of caring for these patients and caring for ourselves.
Do you remember having a moment where you stopped yourself and looked around and thought, what are we in? What is this?
We had so many moments of feeling this is surreal. We haven't seen this before. There was a lot of fear because we were not sure how it was spread and how intensely it was spread. And yes, we had many anxiety-prone moments in the early phases. But as the pandemic evolved, particularly in those first 4 weeks, we became more comfortable as we had sufficient protective equipment for ourselves, and we started to get a handle of how these patients were presenting. But I will say, to this day, it is still an evolving enigma.
So now, 2 to 3 months later, what's the situation in the emergency room? For example, what's it been like this week?
So it's really interesting how the evolution of this has taken place. And first I'll say it's evolved very differently in different parts of the United States for a lot of reasons, one of which is early versus late institution of public health measures like lockdown and distancing, et cetera. But early on, we had, I wouldn't say a tidal wave, but we had a wave of COVID-19 patients, and the emergency department was busy and busy with sick patients with COVID. But as our wave was not that big, then after the wave subsided, we found our emergency department only half full, which was very typical for emergency departments around the country, except for hot spots like New York City, Detroit, New Orleans. And we had a very quiet emergency department in which, yes, we still did see COVID-19 patients, but we were finding that patients with non-COVID disease were not coming to the emergency department, which at first we were reassured by. It allowed us to focus on COVID care, but then we realized that patients with non-COVID disease were just avoiding the emergency department and presenting late with their illness. So that was sort of like the first hump of busyness with COVID, and then the second sort of depression with emergency departments half full. But now we have slowly been increasing our volumes, and now we're probably at 3/4 of our typical volume, and partly because I think the message has been sent out there that it's not safe to avoid your routine medical care and also to avoid emergencies that need to be addressed by us. And we've conveyed the message that, in fact, it's very safe in the hospital here. And Sacramento finally has been very fortunate. Out of the 50 biggest metropolitan regions in the country, we are the lowest in prevalence of COVID-19. So we've been very fortunate in that regard.
It's also one of the reasons, Dr. Cooperman, that much is being said right now about this whole pandemic situation being blown out of proportion. I know you've heard that, and it's coming from all kinds of sectors, and with the pressure economically that we're going through, I think that that message is being more amplified. As a healthcare professional who has seen this through the framing of an emergency department, what about that belief that this was blown up to be much bigger than it actually was?
Yeah, let me take that question straight on. This was not blown up bigger than it was. This is a very serious disease. And all an individual needs to experience is to see one of their loved ones suffer from the severe aspects of this disease, and they will understand how big a crisis this is. So what happens, of course, is that there are big peaks in pockets. So in New York City, almost everyone has had a loved one or a friend affected. And in areas where there's a less prevalence, it's less common. But I want to be very clear, this is not blown up out of proportion. This is a very serious disease. And for those that are sick with this disease, it's one of the scariest things that we have had to try to care for, because it attacks the body in lots of ways, in its blood vessels, in lots of different organs. and patients are very can get very critically sick with this. And as you know, Beth, because I'm sure you know you're reading in the literature, is that if you are sick enough to be placed on a ventilator, your chances of survival are not great. So this is indeed a very serious condition.
So five UC Davis emergency room physicians were sent to help out in New York. Can you give me some perspective in terms of their experience compared to the situation here?
Absolutely. So when we passed our local peak here at UC Davis of COVID patients and we were in this relative lull, we realized that, you know, we have our brothers and sisters in arms across the country that needed help. And that was mostly acutely true in New York. So we have five very altruistic, brave volunteers who went to Queens, New York, which is the epicenter of COVID disease in the United States. And they worked at a hospital called Elmhurst in Queens, and they were desperately needed. And the situation there was very different than our situation at UC Davis. A lot of critically ill patients in the hallways with the care being very good, but very chaotic just because the numbers were outstripping their supplies of clinicians and equipment. At UC Davis, we were fortunate that we never reached that point where the number of patients outstripped our resources, either human or physical, like PPE and ventilators. But their experience in New York was completely different, highlighting that within the United States, we are different countries of COVID, in a sense, with hot spots and quieter spots.
I'm talking with Dr. Nate Cooperman. He is an ER doctor at UC Davis Medical Center. He's also the chair of emergency medicine at UC Davis Health and professor of pediatric emergency medicine. So we're talking about New York, and let's shift gears to talking about children and this illness in children that is linked to COVID-19 but has symptoms of Kawasaki disease. Will you expand on that? What do we know about it now?
Sure. So that the situation in children is fascinating. First of all, and to frame it, this disease, of all the disease, COVID disease in humans, less than 1% or around 1% is in children younger than 10 years of age. So it's infrequent in children, and it's the vast majority is mild disease. So that's a reassuring thing to clinicians and to parents and to society. But having said that, two emerging conditions have been described. One is that there is a subset of children that do get very sick with COVID in a way that's similar to adults. There was a case series published in JAMA Pediatrics just this week of around 50 children in intensive care units throughout the country and the world where they described treatments and the outcomes. And the risk factors were similar to adults. These are children who are typically older, a mean age of around 13, and the ones that were at greatest risk had what we call comorbidities. That is, they have other important illnesses that
right.
put them at risk. Obesity was a factor, again, similar as adults. But now there's a separate group of children. Now, these children are much younger. And just to frame it for your listeners, you know, Kawasaki disease is a disease that was described about half a century ago, and this is an inflammatory condition. That is, where it's a self-limited inflammation of the blood vessels, but it typically presents with fever, rash, the mouth or lips can be cracked and red. The lymph nodes in the neck are typically enlarged, and the hands or feet can be red or swollen, and finally the eyes can be inflamed, that is, they can have conjunctivitis. This is the typical Kawasaki disease that afflicts maybe 1 in 10,000 children, and they're typically young, 3 years of age. Well, what's evolved and what we've seen with COVID-19, and now it's been described in several places, and a really important article just published in Lancet about this, is there's a Kawasaki-like syndrome that is linked to COVID-19. And it's being called the pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, which looks like Kawasaki. The children are typically a bit older, like I said, an average of 7 years as opposed to 3 years. They usually have most, if not all, of the signs and symptoms of Kawasaki disease. Most of the children do have evidence of COVID-19, either by testing from the nasal swab or from the blood. But the difference is that these children have more severe disease. So Kawasaki disease does attack the heart and can give inflammation of the coronary arteries, that is the main arteries leading to the heart. But in the COVID-related Kawasaki disease, there's a much higher frequency of cardiac, that is of heart involvement, with children presenting with critical illness and low blood pressure and signs of heart involvement. So it's still, just again, not to to scare the listeners, it's still very infrequent. However, the prevalence of this condition is now 30 times that it was before the COVID era. So it's a rare disease at baseline, and it's still very uncommon, but we are seeing a fair amount of it, usually at the after the patient is, their nasal pharyngeal swab is negative for COVID, and with more serious manifestations of Kawasaki disease.
All right, let me add a few details. More than 100 children in New York State have been diagnosed, and as you said, more than 60% tested positive for coronavirus. I guess diarrhea and vomiting can go along with it. But here's my final and important question. Do you think that this is a disease that's going to move across the country like COVID-19 has done, or do you get the sense that it's going to be isolated to something going on in New York or in that region?
Yeah, a very good question, Beth. Actually, this is nothing specific to New York. This is linked, I mean, to our best knowledge based on the blood testing and whatnot, to the disease itself. So there are a lot of cases described. The Lancet article I described was from Italy, and it's been described in the UK. It's been described all over the world. The interesting thing is that it doesn't present like typical COVID at the time that someone has fever and breathing difficulties and whatnot. It presents typically later. On.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's likely why the majority of children, their swabs are negative. It's a late finding, and it's likely related to what dermatologists have been seeing. They have been referred children who have their toes and fingers are really red. It's likely one of these sort of vasculitic, that is inflammation of the blood vessel, symptoms of late COVID-19.
All right. I'm with you on the point that we don't want to unnecessarily scare people. But as with the movement of COVID-19, talking about something ahead of time when it's somewhere else in the world and perhaps moving this direction or making people aware of symptoms, I think in a way becomes public service, public health importance. So I think we'll continue this conversation over time, Dr. Cooperman.
Great. But can I just add one last point? And it's a public health message, is that, you know, the hospitals now, hospitals very safe. You know, we all are in masks. We have very little COVID. We only have 2 patients in the hospital with COVID. And my public message to your listeners is that if you're ill, please come to the hospital, come to the emergency department. It's safe, and we are here to care for you. And also, don't avoid bringing your children in for their routine immunizations. Mm. And women should be getting their mammograms, because it's a very safe time to come to the hospital, and I don't want people to avoid their regular health care.
All right. Message delivered. Thank you so much for your time. Be safe. And thank you for all the amazing work of the frontline workers there.
Thanks so much, Beth. Appreciate talking to you.
That is Dr. Nate Cooperman from UC Davis, distinguished professor of both the departments of emergency medicine and pediatric medicine. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Annabella Funk had to come home to Nevada City, California from India when the coronavirus started to move around the world. She's single. She's in her early 20s. Needless to say, her dating world had changed dramatically. And it was true for her childhood friend, Amelia Coffin, too. So they formed a company and created a comedy podcast. It's really a fun uplift, and Annabella's on the phone. Hi, Annabella. Nice to talk with you again. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me on the show.
So you found yourselves at home looking around. What were you thinking when all of a sudden you're back in Nevada City?
Well, so I was actually in India working on a film when this whole pandemic hit. And so it was quite an experience to be living over there, then to have gotten on one of the last flights back to the United States, and then all of a sudden I'm back living in my childhood home again. So it's been quite a journey.
You and Amelia have been friends since first grade?
Yeah.
And so you drive past each other's houses. Did you know you had both landed back in Nevada City?
Yeah, the first thing I did when I got home after getting back with my parents was call Mia.
Mia, you call her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to jump to the podcast, and we're going to listen to a clip because you are actually talking to Amelia about using Zoom to try to talk to a date. And this gives us just a fun sense of the two of you. Here it is from the podcast, Dating When the World is Gonna End.
We both met each other's family, but over Zoom. So my parents said that he couldn't come up because, you know, like my family's never met him because, oh, this is kind of newish. So my family said he couldn't come up until they met him. So he passed the test. Ari was like, I'm a fan. But then, okay, so then what happened yesterday was that his family, Mia, get this. Okay. His family had a lockdown Passover dinner.
Oh.
So with his whole extended family. It was super, super cute. I met like his grandmother and his like his dad and his brother, and there was like 37 family members of his on this Zoom call, and I was like, oh, this is crazy. I can't believe I'm meeting all of these people but through the internet. The weirdest thing. When would this ever happen?
That's so interesting. That's really cool, though. Honestly, I like that.
All right. So that's Annabella and Amelia. So what's the concept for your podcast? You were sharing your experience, but who else are you talking to?
Yeah. So each week on the podcast, we talk about our own lives and our own dating experiences, as you heard, but we also talk to a different guest. So we've had a guest from India on the podcast, and she's a young woman, and she's living in Mumbai. And she talks about what life and dating was like, even as a woman before the pandemic hit. We also talked to, and this is an episode that we're going to release sometime in the next couple weeks, but we talked to an ER nurse in Mexico on raising her daughter. She's a single mom, and it's on raising her daughter during this pandemic and what that looks like.
You are trying to stay relevant and current. And what kind of reaction are you getting from people, Annabella?
So we've been having a really incredible reaction, actually. The outpour of support from the community has been incredible to watch because I feel like this podcast is a way to just not only connect with each other, but to connect with our community. And one of the things we do on the podcast is each week we don't just hear everyone's stories, we also talk about a different local business and how you can best support them. So whether that be curbside pickup or whether that be ordering from a local California business online. So we have a growing list on our website of all of those businesses, and then we also talk about it each week on the podcast because I really feel like, Beth, I really feel like right now more than ever it's so, so important to support our local businesses and our local economy.
So you'd been in Mumbai, and Mia was studying early childhood development in Spanish, I think, at CSU Channel Islands in Ventura. What are the two of you saying about the future?
It's such a crazy time, and the future is so uncertain, and I think that that's kind of the basis for why we really decided to do this podcast, because it's a way for us to get through this uncertainty together.
Well, the podcast is hilarious. I was laughing at the clip. It's so fun and so upbeat. I want to thank you for a really great uplift for all of this. You don't have to be single to listen, right?
No, absolutely not. Actually, we have a couple on the podcast in our episode called The Newlyweds, and they are a newlywed couple living in a tiny one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. And they've been quarantined together, and they actually found out about the pandemic while on their honeymoon in Europe. So we have all sorts of people come on the podcast.
Annabella, you are a delight. Thanks for joining us on Inside. Good luck to you and Amelia in your friendship and your life and all that you, I know, are going to contribute. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Beth, for having me. And ultimately, we're just trying to solve the question of how do we stay connected when we can't be together? Thanks for having me.
All right. That's Annabella Funk with Amelia Coffin. Their podcast is Dating When the World is Gonna End. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. We have one more uplift in the show today. This is the story of a woman who truly leans into life. She is Emily Barsetti Sipa of Sacramento. She's celebrating a very big birthday on Sunday. Her family is listening right now. I think the birthday girl is listening too. So get this about Emily. She was born in 1915. She lived through the Spanish flu pandemic and, in fact, had the flu as a child. So now she can say she's lived through two pandemics. She endured the Depression, and after the attack on Pearl Harbor, she joined the Navy. Emily Barsetti Sipa is one of the oldest living World War II veterans. She was honorably discharged as an ensign. This stay-at-home time hasn't been easy for her because Emily's used to hosting and playing bridge three times a week. She visits with family and friends. She would usually be following her beloved San Francisco Giants right now. But I hear that she's also an avid Golden State Warriors fan, too. She lives in her own home with family. She has five children, six grandchildren, and one great-grandchild. And the plans for a birthday celebration are, as you might imagine, a little bit uncertain right now, but I hope someday we'll be able to talk with Emily on Insight and find out all about the special day. In the meantime, here's a little something to get this Sunday's party started. Emily Barsetti Sipa will be 105 years young this Sunday, May 17th, 2020. You can see a picture from her 100th birthday on our website. It's at capradio.org/insight. I'm told she doesn't look a day older today. Happy birthday, Miss Emily, from all of us. Thank you for the service and the great spirit for life that you've brought to people everywhere. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak with producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez. We want to wish good luck to Anthony Van Hook. He's another popular engineer for Insight. He's moving on to a new and terrific job. Good luck, Anthony. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. We're back at noon with Governor Gavin Newsom's budget message. Until then, take care. Thanks for joining us. And happy birthday, Miss Emily.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.